Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, May 4th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut, Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio just north of New York City. Former athletics pitcher and executive Matt Keough has passed away at the age of 64. That's sad news coming from the Athletics on Sunday. Major League Baseball and the umpires reached a deal on payment for the 2020 season. That was announced by the MLB Umpires Association on Friday, first reported by the Associated Press and confirmed by ESPN. The umpires will be paid a prorated share of their salaries based on days worked and not games over a 182-day season. Per the Associated Press, umpires have already been paid January through April and will be paid at a 50% rate in May. As part of the deal, MLB also has the right not to use instant replay of umpires' decisions this season, according to the AP. And by the way, that's certainly, we know that Major League Baseball at some point is going to take to the Players Association the idea of having salary rollbacks like the umpires just agreed to. Major League Baseball, the show competition, reached the finals. And in the end, Rays pitcher Blake Snell defeated Lucas Giolito with a barrage of home runs. You see Lucas Giolito wave a proverbial white flag as Blake Snell was going crazy. Dave Martinez said last week that his team will wait to properly mark its World Series championship with spectators in the seats. His quote was, "I'm sure that I speak for everyone in our organization. We're going to celebrate somehow, some way. We want to hang the banner with fans. We want to get our rings with fans. When? We don't know. How? We don't know. But we want them to be involved." That came via a video call with reporters from Dave's farm in Tennessee. And I'm sure, Taylor, that he probably has finished some of his indoor remodeling with his carpentry. What do you think?
Well, let's hope so. He's had plenty of time to do it. Maybe he's worked on his yard, too.
There we go. Well, today we're going to be talking with Jeff Idelson, the former president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He has so many stories about Hall of Famers, whether it's Derek Jeter or Yogi Berra or Jim Rice, or the moment when Bruce Sutter was told he was in the Hall of Fame. You'll be surprised by his reaction. We'll also be talking with Sarah Langs. And before we get to them, don't forget it's a Monday after another airing of ESPN's The Last Dance. That means you have two new episodes of Jalen and Jacoby, The After Show, to check out. The guys are recapping episodes 5 and 6 of The Last Dance with director Jason Hare. The Jalen and Jacoby After Show, presented by State Farm and AT&T, has been a great companion to the series that everyone is talking about. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Numbers Game.
Sarah Lang's a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, we got word from Dave Martinez, the Nationals manager, on Friday that the Nationals are going to wait until there are fans in the stands before they celebrate the 2019 World Series championship. And that seems totally appropriate to me. And I'm glad he said it out loud. How about you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's so much uncertainty and we definitely don't know when that necessarily will be. But, you know, if I'm a Nationals fan, it's the first ever, you know, World Series for that organization. And even if it wasn't the first World Series, I just think that that's something that those moments are so great, right? Those ring ceremonies and everything else. And even if it has to be whenever down the line, I'm glad that they'll wait to share that with the fans, because, you know, the players and the team, they've celebrated it, but the fans aren't there in the locker room, you know, when there's champagne spraying and everything else. So that's their moment. So I'm glad they'll still get to have it whenever it is.
I hope that, for example, if it were to take place in 2021 instead of 2020, I hope that Major League Baseball can schedule it for a day, build in a day where there are very few games that we always get in April. And that way, if the players, you know, because let's face it, with all these championship teams, there are always a number of players that disperse to other clubs. 2 years after the fact, there'll probably be more players dispersed. And that's why I hope that this is scheduled on a day when there are very few games. So maybe some players can travel back the way that Dave Roberts did after the Red Sox won the 2004 World Series.
Yeah, I like that. I think that there's definitely more considerations to, you know, to make when you're talking about potentially celebrating a World Series title, basically, you know, a full year after. But because there probably is so much time to think about it, hopefully they can really, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's and do something like that. I remember, I don't think it was on opening day, but I remember how emotional it was when Juan Uribe got his World Series ring in 2011 after going to the Dodgers and how all the everyone, it was after the tragedy with Brian Stowe had happened, and all of the players like converged and hugged him, and it was Giants players hugging a Dodgers player, and that was not something you're used to seeing. So, you know, more moments like that, and just regardless of where players may be.
In a minute, we'll be talking with Jeff Idelson, the former president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He's got a great story about Derek Jeter. ESPN next week will run a game from Derek Jeter's career, and on ESPN.com, they're asking fans to vote on which game they're going to run. And they had five choices, Sarah. First choice, and I'm going to make you pick one of these five. The Jeffrey Mayer game, October 9th, 1996, where the Jeffrey Mayer play in Yankee Stadium. Derek was the one who hit that ball. The Mr. November game, October 31st, 2001. Actually, Derek gonna hit the game-winning walk-off home run, and it happened in after midnight, which is why he was called Mr. November. The dive in a game against the Red Sox, July 1st, 2004. Hit number 3,000, July 9th, 2011, against David Price of the Tampa Bay Rays. Derek Jeter's, the fifth one is Derek Jeter's Bronx farewell, September 25th, 2014. Of course, he had the walk-off hit to end it. And before we get to any of those five, I'm sitting there looking at this list. I'm like, where's the flip play, Sarah? Like, the flip play to me, I would have that, if it were up to me, in place of the dive. Well, how about you?
Yeah. Or
the Jeffrey Mayer game. Like, I feel like that Derek was more sort of ancillary to the Jeffrey Mayer game. What do you think?
Well, yeah, because Bernie Williams hit the walk-off home run. You know, I was looking back at that box score, and I that's not a game I remember live too well because I was pretty young, but I was looking back at it, and I mean, that's the play, and that's what everyone thinks of, but he didn't even win the game. He tied the game. I think if I were to pick one, I don't know. I was torn between either Mr. November or the 3,000th hit. I mean, the Mr. November, even though they don't win the series, you know, he only had two walk-off home runs in his career in the regular season, the postseason. That's one of them, you know. So I think that that alone just shows you rising to the occasion, all the things we think of with Derek Jeter. But his 3,000th hit, he had a great game. He had five hits that day. He was, at the time, the second guy ever to homer for his 3,000th hit. He had a home run off David Price, and then Alex Rodriguez joined that list later. The other guy to do it had been Wade Boggs. So, I don't know, kind of torn there whether we want the postseason, you know, or the regular season. Obviously, postseason stakes are higher, but I think I'd pick one of those two.
Yeah, your instinct on Mr. November, I think that's the right one. Not only because when you think about the broadcast – not only did he walk it off with a home run, but that game was incredible.
Yeah.
Like the back and forth that happened in that game, the Yankees down 2-1 in that World Series. You have the first of two game-tying two-run homers in the ninth inning. Tino Martinez hits a home run, tied the game in the bottom of the ninth to set up Derek. So, yeah, that's the one I would go with as well.
And he homered on the ninth pitch of the at-bat. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, you know, first pitch, whatever. It was a, you know, back and forth. And he only had two homers in his whole career that were deeper into an at-bat in the regular season or the postseason. So it was a battle.
And I got to tell you, if Twitter had been around in 2001, every person, like a million people simultaneously, would have tweeted out Mr. November.
Yeah,
like come up with that idea, you know, given that it was the Yankees and Reggie Jackson was Mr. October. On Tuesday, we're going to be talking with Marcus Semien at the beginning of our MVP week. Marcus Semien finished third last year in the voting for the American League MVP. And one of the plays that I asked him about, moments that I asked him about, was a throw that Ramon Laureano made in 2018. The greatest throw I've ever seen. It was incredible, and you and I have talked about it in the past. When I sent you a note on that I wanted to ask you about that, you mentioned it last week on MLB.com. You guys had an article putting together the ultimate five-tool players. And given that you pick a player for the hit tool, another for the power tool, then speed tool, glove, arm, tell me who your five were.
Yeah. So we had some rules with this. It was active players. And obviously everyone could only be taken once. And the idea with, as we picked, and we did it in like a draft order, in the order you said, so hit, power, speed, glove, and arm. The idea was that you wouldn't be picking anybody for your personal player who was like better than the last guy at that tool. So like taking Mike Trout is actually kind of difficult because he's going to be better than the next guy you pick for power, theoretically. So I'm just going to start out by saying that. So I ended up with Jeff McNeil for hitting, Gary Sanchez power, Tim LeCastro speed, Victor Robles glove, and then Ramon Laureano arm, which is why I thought of him when you were mentioning that Semien was talking about that play. So that play, that assist, it went 321 feet that he threw that ball. That is the longest tracked assist on the fly in the StatCast era, which is since 2015, by a lot. And he threw it more than 90 miles an hour, which, you know, outfield throws, sure, they get a little running start, but we're still talking about some really good arm strength there. I was actually watching that playback last week when I was writing this. And Dallas Braden, in the background of the call, if you go Google it, go listen on YouTube, is absolutely outstanding because he was like the sideline and they do the thing where he's sort of just talking with the two guys in the booth. And he just starts going, "Oh my God. Oh my God." And it's like, that's the only thing you can do reacting to that throw because it was incredible. And he made a great catch to start it too. He's kind of like reaching out, almost laying out and then somehow turning around to make that throw. So. I mean, absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, and I wrote about this play a few weeks ago. I talked to Ramon Laureano, and this was interesting. I didn't know this. He told me that he actually envisioned that play a couple of pitches before because he was mad. He had struck out a couple times that game. He was like, you know what? If the ball's hit to my right, like Justin Upton was at the plate for the Angels and Laureano was playing center field. So if the ball's hit to my right, left center field, he said, I'm going to run through the wall. I don't care. I'm going to crash into the wall. And that's exactly where the ball was hit, left center field. Yeah. And he stops and he makes that throw. And Marcus Semien and others in the Oakland infield, they went into full spectator mode, like watching this incredible throw coming in from the outfield, this laser. The reactions from all the players were funny. And I think Cole Calhoun of the Angels said something to Laureano, if I remember correctly, like, take it easy, bro. Take it easy. He had such admiration for how long he'd made that play. All right. So I'm going to come up with my team. And thankfully, yes. I'm not subject to the same restrictions that you had. But here would be mine. For hit tool, I've got the best hitter in baseball. I got Anthony Rendon.
Yep.
Does that sound reasonable?
Yes.
Okay. Power, Aaron Judge.
Yep.
He's crazy. Speed, Byron Buxton.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Glove, Matt Chapman. Okay, and arm, I've got Laureano as well. I mean, are those unreasonable? By the way, Nolan Arenado, I saw last year, I remember watching him do a demonstration with Alex Rodriguez from third base making these laser throws from one knee at third base.
Oh, yeah. No, incredible. Everyone you picked was picked by somebody. So certainly, guys that we were all thinking of. And I mean, Judge got taken like right before me when I took Gary Sanchez for power. So I was certainly thinking along those lines as well. And Buxton's speed is outstanding. He was taken also right before I took Tim LeCastro, who did lead the majors in sprint speed last year, but, you know, not as much playing time, like 250 plate appearances. But it was really fun, you know, going through all these. And it's fun to break down the players this way. And we have such outstanding, so many players in the majors right now, even if they're not complete five tool players, to me at least, are like absolutely outstanding at maybe three of these. So it's really fun to kind of piece this together.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this. Good to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Jeff Idelson served as the president of Baseball's Hall of Fame until last year when he became the co-founder of Grassroots Baseball, which you can learn about at grassrootsbaseball.com. He and co-founder Gene Frith promoted their new book last year, Grassroots Baseball, Where Legends Begin, by making a tour along historic Route 66 through eight states, traveling 2,448 miles. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Buster, it's good to be with you. And Grassroots Baseball, absolute blast last year. I mean, working for the Hall of Fame, obviously, for 25 years has incredible meaning to me. But the Grassroots Baseball is a chance for Gene and me to give back and to try to grow the game incrementally at the youngest levels. And we launched last year, as you mentioned, along Route 66. We got through all eight states that encompasses driving an RV full of Rawlings baseball gloves and baseballs and Big League Chew gum. And we did 10 clinics along the way, mostly with Boys and Girls Clubs. We brought in Hall of Famers and other Route 66 legends, guys like Trevor Hoffman, George Brett, Jim Thome, Goose Gossage, who's our national spokesman, Billy Hatcher, who's from Williams, Arizona, Johnny Bench, and basically brought these guys in. Look, I did this growing up here, and if I can do this, you can do this. And words of inspiration like that and about following your dreams. And then every kid got a new Rawlings glove and Rawlings ball. And I think in a lot of cases, we really sparked some interest in seeing these kids go to the next level. This year, we began in Puerto Rico, and during the Caribbean Series, and had a clinic with Pudge Rodriguez down there at the Boys and Girls Club in Santurce, where Orlando Cepeda's sister worked for years. And we're fast-tracking to do a number of clinics there next year as we continue on with grassroots baseball as a give-back program.
What were a couple of moments from last year that absolutely jumped out at you that always stick with you, stick in your heart?
I think there were a couple. You know, Union League Boys and Girls Club in downtown Chicago, we went there in May and went in with Goose Gossage to that club. And, you know, these are kids who are shy. Some of them aren't. Some of them are. And Goose picked out a kid that he thought it'd be fun to play catch with. And he, at first he thought he was going to hurt him because the kid just didn't seem to have much ability. But his confidence grew. And, you know, by the end, that he was having a really meaningful game of catch. And the young man, you know, really seemed to be enjoying himself. His older brother came up to Goose after and said, "I've never seen my brother so engaged. I've never even seen him throw a baseball." And then the young man told Goose that he planned to go out for the summer team. So small stories like that, we heard a bunch of them around, really hit home for us. You know, seeing Billy Hatcher walk into his old high school in Williams and kids going up to him and saying, are you the Billy Hatcher? It's just something you don't get to witness every day. And it was an unexpected visit. And all of a sudden he is like the Pied Piper. So these guys still have meaning around the country. And of that entire 2,400 mile trip on the way out, Buster, I drove all but 0.8 of a mile in Amarillo, Texas, when Trevor Hoffman in full Padres uniform insisted on driving this thing to the ballpark.
Now, from what I read, there's going to be another book coming out of that last summer, correct?
There is. We're working on Grassroots Baseball Route 66, which will come out in the next year. And same kind of concept. Guys like Jim Thome, Ryan Howard, George Brett, Johnny Bench, Adam LaRoche, Billy Hatcher. Guys like this are going to be headlining this this book, which we know will have a similar effect. And again, all proceeds that derive from the book will go back into making this program bigger and better, both inside the United States and outside around the country.
Now, I'm a little bit surprised you turned the wheel over to Trevor Hoffman, because you've heard the story about him in cars, right? The moment when he ran over the car when the Padres were playing at Pittsburgh.
I don't remember that story, and it's probably good that I didn't.
So what happened was, and I think it was Bruce Bochy told us the story in the podcast that Trevor, Larry Lucchino and Bruce Bochy, and I think Kevin Towers was in the car, late great Kevin Towers. They pull into a hotel, and all of a sudden they hear this absolute bang on the hood and then on the roof of the car. And what happened was is that Trevor, who during his playing days had a reputation being a wild man, ran over the top of the car. And Larry Lucchino was not happy about it to see his closer racing over the top of the taxi they were in. And by the way, the taxi cab driver wasn't thrilled about it either.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me about Trevor, but I'm pleased to report that he was able to make it down the street and in downtown Amarillo and not run over anything as we pulled up to the Sod Poodle Stadium for our clinic with the Boys and Girls Club.
Oh, he's the best. All right. So I wanted to have you on. We're looking for some distraction during this time without baseball and some storytelling. And you obviously have a million from your time as president of Baseball's Hall of Fame. You sent me this great list, which I'm going to work from. But as I was thinking about getting ready for this interview, you know, so many of the Hall of Famers I talk to always speak of looking forward to playing golf because there's a golf course right next to the hotel where they stay, the Otisaga, and they talk about, you know, different foursomes they play with. And it occurred to me you probably got in to some of those foursomes through the years.
Yeah, I mean, my job was over Hall of Fame weekend was pretty much – didn't allow me to play then, but I played with a bunch of these guys at Cooperstown over the years. And, you know, some fun stories, of course, you know, thinking back, you know, my first day with the Hall of Fame, was induction day 94. when Phil Rizzuto and Steve Carlton and Leo DeRocher were inducted that weekend. And, you know, that great story about Phil Rizzuto and Yogi golfing, Yogi, the late, great Yogi Berra. They're out on the golf course, and Rizzuto lines up the putt and makes it about halfway to the hole. And then he, you know, says to nobody in particular, "Oh, you Huckleberry, how could you do that?" To which Yogi responds, "Don't worry, Scooter. Everybody knows that 70% of all putts left short don't go in." So, you know, you have a Yogiism born right there on the golf course, one of many with him. You know, I think about Johnny Bench and him hitting the ball on the seventh hole, which is a long par four uphill, well over the road, which is about three quarters of the way up to the hole, well over 300 yards. And there's a placard there to memorialize the longest hit, if you will, in the history of the golf course. And, you know, the one of my other really fun stories from there is when Jim Rice came up for his orientation visit in the spring before he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2009, we weren't able to golf because it wasn't, he just didn't have enough time, but he really wanted to see the golf course. And everybody who knows Jim Rice knows he loves to golf. So I took him out in a cart, and it was really quiet. It was March, and it was like one guy out there. And so we're pulling up behind this guy on the eighth fairway, and he's about 100 yards from the pin, and he's getting ready to hit. So I slow down, and Jim says, "Nah, go on up to him." So, all right. So go up to him, and here is this guy standing there, Buster, and not only is a golfer, he's wearing a Red Sox hat. And he looks at me, he looks at Jim Rice, and he's just looking at both of us. And Jim Rice says, "Hey, you got a wedge there?" And the guy says, "Of course I have a wedge." So he pulls his wedge up. "Has he got a ball?" He gives Jim Rice a ball. Jim Rice hits his wedge, puts it about 3 feet from the pin, and just says to the guy, "You know, have a nice time here at the Otisaga." We drive away. The next day, I get a call from the sales manager of the hotel saying, "Do you know who that was that Jim Rice hit a golf ball for?" I said, "I think it's some Red Sox fan who's probably very happy now." "Is this the editor of Golf Digest?" So you just never know what you're going to get when you're on Weatherstock and golf course with these guys.
Oh, my goodness. Tell me what your impressions. I was lucky enough when I covered the Yankees for the New York Times to be around Yogi Berra, get to know him a little bit. And I just always enjoyed talking with him because the thing that struck me was he was so current in his knowledge. You have any Yogi Berra experiences that you want to relate?
Yeah, I mean, and people know him for the Yogiisms, and I have another homemade one from Cooperstown that he laid on me. But this is a guy who, you know, was really smart and really good at what he did, knew the game inside and out, and very current. And if, you know, you talk to Craig Biggio about him at any time, I think the two guys that he'll point to the most for really helping his career are Matt Galante and, of course, Yogi Berra down in Houston. But one time, I'd say about 8 or 9 years ago, I come into Hall of Fame weekend and into the Otisaga Resort Hotel on Saturday morning. It's about 6:30 in the morning, 6:15, and there's nobody there. And I go and get myself a cup of coffee, and I walk out onto the back veranda, which is just gorgeous. For those who haven't been there, there's this gorgeous view of the lake with all these high back, classic Adirondack white rocking chairs. And the only person out there, I see the top of his head, is Yogi. He's the only person up at that hour other than me. So I go and I sit down next to him, and he has a cup of coffee, and he just kind of nods at me, "How you doing, kid?" And we're sitting there rocking and, you know, just sort of looking out at the scenery. And he says to me, you know, there was a light mist falling. And he says to me, "You know, how come it always rains Hall of Fame weekend?" I said, "Look, Yogi, we're here in Cooperstown. We're at the base of this 9-mile long lake, Lake Otsego. We're nestled between two mountain ranges, the Adirondacks and the Catskills. And in the summer, it's really not unusual for, you know, a storm to blow through like this one is. And it just happens from time to time. It happens." And he didn't say anything. And about a minute and a half passes, and he's still looking straight ahead. And he says, "Why don't you just move it to another weekend when it doesn't rain?" What else can you say?
What a story. Ricky Henderson, we talked to Sandy Alderson last week about him. And he talked about, you know, there was a public perception about Ricky, and then there was the way Ricky really was. What do you got on him?
Funny you say that, because I often thought that Yogi and Ricky at times were separated by birth from different mothers. But Ricky, I've known a long time. I was with the Yankees when he played there in his second tour of duty. And then we traded him to the A's for Eric Plunk, Greg Catterae, and Luis Polonia. But I got to know Ricky a little bit in New York. And then, of course, when he made it to the Hall of Fame, and I remember we were bringing him in, he got in late. He got into Albany like 8 o'clock at night. We had dinner on the way back, and I'm telling him everything I can about the Hall of Fame. And that's when I asked him the one question. I said to him, you know, Ricky, why is it that you always go head first into a base? And it's such a short, abbreviated drop into the base. Why don't you elongate yourself? And he says to me, you ever seen a plane? I said, yeah, I'm on them all the time. He said, you ever see how a plane lands? Like, especially in Burbank, where there are mountains? I said, yeah. He goes, well, if a plane can drop, why can't I? Fair enough. Fine. So we get to the hotel, and I said, look, we got you a great room over. It's about 9 o'clock at night at this point, or 9:30. So we got a great room for you, Ricky. It's overlooking the lake. It's a gorgeous view. I hope you like, you know, welcome to Cooperstown. I see him the next morning for breakfast. I said, what'd you think of the view? He said, there was no view. It was dark outside. No. But I'm also young enough that I got to see him play at Fenway, Buster. And I often said to my friends, and I really do believe this, that he is one of the few guys that you thought could change a game or do something. He was a guy that as a teenager, high school or college kid, I would pay to go see, because he was either going to hit a leadoff home run, he was going to steal a bag or two, he was going to make a snap catch, he was going to talk to the fans, and really the ultimate performer. And to a lot of people, a hot dog. But to me, this guy was just unbelievable as a player, and worth the price of admission.
He was one of the players when the Hall of Fame vote total was announced. I was shocked at the number of people didn't vote for him, because my feeling of, my God, he's one of the greatest players in the history of baseball. If you look at, you know, how he impacted the game, Sandy Alderson talked about that last week. I wanted to ask you again, you and I have had conversations at Patch about Ichiro and his love for baseball and for baseball history. Can you run through that?
Yeah, he's just he's someone that I've just been fortunate enough to have had a long relationship with, Buster. You know, I had some friends in the Japanese media in the mid-90s, and they sort of alerted me to him. A friend of mine at Kyoto News, A.G. Yamazaki, who was the bureau chief in New York, he and I used to talk in 93, 94, 95 about Ichiro. And, you know, I followed him at the end of his career in Oryx when he was winning 7 straight batting titles and the 3 MVPs, and then was really excited for him to come to Seattle. And, you know, so I'm following his career from afar. And in that rookie year, 2001, he breaks Shoeless Joe Jackson's hit record for rookies. And, you know, granted, he had played in Japan, but nonetheless, like with Negro Leagues players, when they came in, they're considered rookies, even though they played in another league. So I asked through Tim Heavily if Ichiro would donate the bat that he used to break Jackson's mark to Cooperstown, and he ended up sending us a bat that he used in September, but not the one that he used to break the record, which is okay, because you can still storytell and talk about a game used bat from Ichiro. And I didn't think anything of it. And that offseason, he came in under the radar. He came in late October, early November, for a visit to the Hall of Fame. And I was absolutely thrilled, because I had never met the guy. I had gotten a bat from him from Oryx. I had worked through the club to get one, I believe, in 98 or 99. So this he was going to be hand-delivering this bat that he had used in September, which he did. But when he came, what struck me is that, a couple of things. First of all, his interest was our art collection, and that's where it started. And so I'm thinking to myself, it's not often that you get someone coming to a baseball museum who wants to start by, you know, going deep into your art collection. So it told me a lot about him and his desire to, you know, learn about the cultural aspect of the game as much as the playing aspect. The other thing of note that year was that he said, listen, I've got to take a phone call. Can we use your office? And I said, sure. And he was with his wife and Brad Lefton and a couple of other folks. And it turns out that he was winning the Rookie of the Year that day, and the American League Rookie of the Year. And so he gets on the phone with the media from Seattle, and this is before caller ID. This is before cell phones were really heavy and prevalent. And they ask him, where are you? And he says, I'm in the United States. That's all you need to know. And for 7 or 8 years, nobody ever knew where he was when he won Rookie of the Year, and he was sitting in my office. So that was kind of fun. I went to see him the next year, and we had a great conversation, and he told me that he was embarrassed that he had not given the bat to us that we had asked for. But now, since he had come to Cooperstown and realized how important the history is to the public, that we, you know, that he felt badly, and that going forward, he would certainly, whenever we wanted something, help us out. He has come back subsequently 7 more times, so 8 total times to the Hall of Fame. he was fully involved in understanding our bat collection. He likes to listen to the sound of tapping on the bat and how much space is between the grains. He especially was into that with George Sisler when he broke Sisler's record in 04. We had one of Sisler's bats in Cooperstown in the glove. And every time he's been there, he's really, really celebrated the game. In 04, when he broke Sisler's mark, he gave us all of his equipment. And then shortly thereafter, Buster, he joined Hank Aaron and Tom Seaver as three of the guys who have pledged to donate their entire collections to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
That's remarkable. Just to follow up a little bit, can you just describe the way that he handled, for lack of a better way to describe it, George Sisler's bat? That's fascinating to me that he was that interested.
Yeah, well, he really wants to. He really appreciates history so much, Buster, that it was his mission to learn everything he could about George Sisler as he was breaking the single season hit mark in 04. And you know, to the point of you know, really just looking at his equipment and pretending to immerse himself in being Sisler. And what he does with bats is he uses his thumb and his middle finger to gently hold them on the barrel up by the top in a vertical position, and then he'll take a finger from his other hand and tap the bat lightly on the barrel and hold it up to his ear to hear the echo and the sound it makes. And he can tell how strong a bat is, how good the wood is, based on the sound that it makes to him.
Tony Gwynn used to do the same thing when I covered the Padres. He would hold a bat. You'd be in a conversation with Tony, and he'd be checking his bats, and he'd hold up his ear and hit it with his palm while holding it with the other hand. So it explains why those two guys are so good at what they did. This note that you sent, I'm fascinated by. You mentioned tidbits from Hall of Fame calls for that moment when they get the call that they're going into the hall. Eddie Murray, the word you sent was subterfuge.
Yeah, it's, you know, every guy it's different. And for a number of years, I was part of the phone calls with our chairman, Jane Forbes Clark, and Jack O'Connell, and part of that process until the MLB Network was born, and then flipped over to Secaucus, where I give the results live. But when Eddie went into the Hall of Fame, Jack gave him a call, and Jane got on, and he was very quiet, no emotion, just thanked Jack, thanked Jane, and said that you know, he appreciated it, and that was it. And they, you know, we were all looking at each other kind of stunned, wondering if it mattered to Eddie. And what happened is Eddie didn't, he was in the car with his wife at the time and didn't say anything to her. And he was on the way to unfortunately to a family funeral, and he didn't want anything to interrupt the sadness that they were all feeling, especially something like him being elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame. So they finish up, the funeral ends, and they're hosting people back at the house. And so they stop at Costco on the way back. And, you know, they're checking out at the checkout line, and the Costco sales clerk looks at Eddie Murray, recognizes him, and says, "Hey, Eddie, congratulations on getting into the Baseball Hall of Fame." And his wife is like, "You didn't tell me?" And so anyway, that's how Eddie sort of kept it quiet. And it was through, you know, somebody in a business that his wife ends up finding out he got in the Hall of Fame.
Bruce Sutter's call. How did that go?
Bruce is more after the fact. Bruce is, as you know, is one of the most humble people I know, for a closer especially. And this is a guy that still never could believe he got in. And then every time I called him between January and July, he would pick up the phone and he'd say, when I'd call and he'd say, "Oh no, 607 number. I'm sure you're calling to tell me that you miscounted and I'm not in the Hall of Fame. Hey, Bruce, you're very much in the Hall of Fame."
Wow. Wow.
Wade Boggs couldn't believe it. Wade, I had known since I worked for Boston in 86, 7, and 8. So I'd had a relationship with Wade. And Jack gets on the phone and says, "Wade, you're in the Hall of Fame." And Wade thinks it's a prank, puts Jane on the phone and says the same thing. This is Jane Clark, chairman of the Hall of Fame. And he still doesn't believe it. He says, I just don't believe it. You need to put on someone I know." So luckily I was there, and I get on the phone. I said, "Boggsy, it's real. You're in." He's like, "You're kidding me." "No, you're in." And so that was Wade Boggs' response and reaction to becoming a Hall of Famer.
Oh, my goodness. And Ken Griffey Jr., who, of course, when he was voted in at that time, this is before Mariano Rivera got in unanimously, Ken Griffey Jr. got the highest percentage vote total of anyone, or excuse me, highest percentage of votes of any candidate in the history of the Hall of Fame. What was that call like?
Well, that was a case where I was at the network, so I didn't talk to Junior that day. But when I knew what was going on before I went on the air, I'm very, very good friends with Tom Seaver from the years and years of working with him, starting when he came over from the White Sox to the Red Sox for Steve Lyons in July of 86. And I felt like I owed Seaver a call because I know he was always very, very proud of having the highest percentage of votes of anyone who got into the Hall of Fame. And I said, look, Tom, I'm about to go on the air. And before you hear it on TV, I want to let you know that Ken Griffey Jr. surpassed you. It finally happened after all these years, 1991 till now. And I just want to make sure you knew. And he said, you know what? He said, if anyone was going to break my record for highest percentage, I'm glad it's him. I remember him as a little kid running around in the clubhouse. And I just couldn't be more proud of someone like him who just exudes class.
That's awesome. And last one, you sent along this note. You got a Derek Jeter story related to your kids.
Yeah, you know, Derek, on my way out of the Yankees and heading to Cooperstown, one of my last times there was when Derek got signed by the Yankees. When we signed him, so I, you know, had a long relationship with knowing him. And in 2011, the year he was going for 3,000 hits, I went down to see him in Tampa to see what he might want to donate to the Hall of Fame when that time came, which would be in July. And so we had a nice conversation, and he asked me, how's your family doing? How are your kids? I said, they're great. I said, I have to tell you, my daughter, Nicole, she's 11, Derek, and she's a huge fan of yours. And he said, well, is she a Yankee fan? I said, yeah, of course she is. I said, but her older brother, Aaron, who's 15, is a much bigger Red Sox fan. And he looked me right in the eye without missing a beat. And he said, Jeff, everybody knows girls are smarter than boys. You tell that to an 11-year-old girl, Buster, you are dad for life.
Oh, what a story. That's classic Derek, too. I see the little wry sense of humor when he said it to you as well. All right, Jeff, these are great stories. You got a billion of them, and I always appreciate you sharing some of this on the show.
Buster, I want to leave you with one last thought. You know, we're dealing with this horrific pandemic, the coronavirus, and it's amazing how we often say that society and baseball, American society and culture and baseball are tied at the hip. And if you think of the two most dominant terms that are going on right now, they both are related to baseball and they both benefit hitters. You want to be, they're talking about flattening the curve, which every hitter hopes every pitcher will do. And then thought being that to practice social distancing and to do it safely, ban the shift.
I love it. And, yeah, you do have to get that on a T-shirt.
We'll work on it.
All right, Jeff. I appreciate it.
All right, Buster. Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be with you.
So last week, my colleague Sam Miller wrote a story about a baseball card which had a different date for Don Mattingly's birth date than what was had been recorded. And Sam wrote this great piece about it. I retweeted it about this piece. Well, Don Mattingly's son, Preston, saw this. He oversees Mattingly Charities. And he posted this video on Saturday on their Twitter feed in which he asked Don Mattingly about that controversy. Give a listen. This is very funny.
And this is one of the questions I wanted to get to. I don't know if you saw 2 days ago, 3 days ago, there was a big ESPN story. I mean, Buster Olney like tweeted us about it. Wondering, there's a controversy apparently surrounding your birthday.
Right.
So a guy ran a story saying that, I guess at one
point. We must all be quarantined.
Yeah.
Worried about that.
We must be.
we must be quarantined.
For one, is your birthday April 20th, 1961 or 1962?
61.
Okay.
It's
61. So Buster Olney, if you're in, Sam Miller, I think, was the other. It's 1961.
Yeah. I messed around. Honestly, I'll tell the story real quick.
Okay.
I'll do a quick one. You know, you're 20. I think I'm 21 or something. And the writers in New York, they're always around, whatever. And they're like, oh, you're going to be 22. And I've got, no, I'm going to be 21. I'm like, dude, I'm 20. I'm going to be 20. I'm 20. I'm going to be 21. So, you know, you always want to get younger, right? And so like, no, you got to bring your birth certificate. So you had those little photocopy birth certificates that had a one on it. And we just kind of, you know, whited it out, put a two, photocopied it again. And those guys bought it, right?
Oh.
So it was like, so we were just messing around. Next thing I know, it's in a, on a baseball card.
Yeah,
so,
it's on.
Yeah, so I kind of caused the problem.
And I didn't know if that was, I didn't realize you went to those great lengths to actually pull that off. That's pretty serious. So I'm going to tell Buster and Sam that that was true, because they said that, they actually said that you were sick of being asked about a slump. And so that you just made up the story that your birth date was wrong at the time. But
I think they're making that up.
Okay.
Right there.
Good to know. I told them I would get the answer on that, and we just got it. So.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Monday. And you'll probably hear, I'll have to speak a little bit louder. We got some lawn mowing in the background, so it's kind of kind of spring training reminiscent when Buster used to go on the road and you'd be like, excuse the background noise. You know, they got stuff going on here at the stadium. So a little bit of that vibe going on today.
Yeah, 100%. And probably your landscaper, the person mowing your lawn outside, has probably got a dandelion weapon in his back pocket someplace.
Oh, for sure. And since we're talking dandelions, let's bring it up. First of all, we've got a couple folks online that are like, enough of the dandelion talk. And I say to that, we got nothing else to talk about. So we're going to continue on. And Brian Pekelnicki wrote in, I ordered a Fisker's Four Claw Weeder after listening to this week's pods. It is no joke. Highly recommend. Works great and is satisfying to see the full root come out. He tweeted a picture at it. You know, I feel like we should get a kickback from Fisker's. I mean, we should get them as a sponsor on the pod.
100%. And you know what? I used one. I actually reached out to my neighbor. And asked him before I placed my order, and I said, hey, do you have one of these? He goes, yeah, I've got one. I don't really use it that much. He brought it over. I used it. Man, it was a crusher. Like, and my son also got it. And by the way, people have sent in recipes for dandelions and that, you know, for dandelion salad. What I have learned in doing my research is in the area around me, a lot of pesticides are thrown in. So I will not be having dandelions. In any kind of a dandelion salad. I don't use pesticides on my lawn, but a lot of people live around us do. And so I'm just not going to mess with it.
That's a great point. Cause I was getting ready to do that myself. I thought it would be funny to do on the podcast, but yeah, pesticides. Yep. We're not messing around with that.
Nope.
All right. Charlie B at A Fish and His Chips writes in, Mariners catcher Tom Murphy went on Mariners Inside Corner and talked about his fears as a catcher with no fan games and how without noise, a batter will know where he's crouching and so it's coming. What do you think about this and any other possible unintended consequences of having fit games without fans?
Yeah, that's a great point that Tom Murphy made. What I wondered about is adrenaline. And you watched The Last Dance on Sunday, and there was a recounting of a practice scrimmage that took place with the Dream Team in 1992. And to hear those guys like playing in an empty gym, would you agree with me, Taylor? It was so unusual. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, these guys are going at it. And look, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Charles Barkley, they were all providing their own adrenaline. But I thought about pitchers who feed off that, especially closers. You know, they come in with their music and the fans stand and they scream and their velocity jumps. I wonder if that's going to be an issue for some pitchers, is that they won't, if in fact there are games without fans in the stands, if pitchers will have to try to create their own energy and their own adrenaline, that could be challenging for some guys.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, you know, every sport is looking at doing this, but I feel like baseball is the one that is most crowd dependent. Like, I feel like so many things live and die with the crowd. So you're right. It'll be fascinating to see how these guys get up for playing these games.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Alrighty, Ryan Bauman at Baugh31 writes in, Buster, what vintage baseball park would you have wanted to watch a game at?
No doubt, Ebbets Field. You know, grew up a Dodger fan, and Ebbets Field was a place that I always want to see. And that's it was interesting the other day when we were talking to Jana Marie Smith about you know, that old fashioned look and why people like to look back at you know, the ballpark that you know, is referenced so often is Ebbets Field, and it makes sense because it looks like it was absolutely a great fan experience.
Mm-hmm. All right, last one for today. This is a contentious question for me personally. We talked on Friday about how I am the doorkeeper of Bleacher Tweets here, and basically someone annoyed me into submission to asking a question. I don't want to do this often. I don't want to appear weak to the listeners, but Casey Gundy writes in. He says, case busted, timely tie-in. Will my question finally be answered? His question he's been asking for a long time now. Why don't teams pre-test their players for banned substances so they aren't blindsided by random testing? I'm sure it's against the rules, but then again, so is sign stealing. I think I know the answer to this, Buster, but do share. What do you have on your mind?
Yeah, teams can't test players. Teams have no ability to test players. All the testing has to be done by Major League Baseball under the protocol that's agreed to by MLB and the Player Association. If any team actually went to a player with a test, let's say a clubhouse guy said, hey, yeah, the general manager says he wants you drug tested, that would be a big deal. Like, first off, the player wouldn't be subjected to testing, and the team would face major penalties for attempting to do that.
The player would respond, I'm getting on the phone with my lawyer right now.
Exactly. It would never happen.
All right. There you go, Casey Gundy. That is Bleacher Tweets for today. Thanks for everyone for writing in, especially on the weekends. We have a lot of people listening on the weekends and giving feedback, and I love that. That's great.
Absolutely. That's it for today. My thanks to Jeff, to Sarah, to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe. And again, on Tuesday, we're going to be talking with Mark Kosemian of the Oakland Athletics.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.